Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who can't stop thinking about a man he walked past 30 years ago. It's Richard Herring.
Thank you very much. Hello, London. So good to be back. Thank you very much. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. But I was talking to Tim Key the other day. It's a little cartoon character, Tim Key, from the Eastern European. He calls it Rahalastapas. So I don't know that's going to... That's going to catch on. The third week in a row... fifth week in a row that I've driven it in my electric car, because they told us the petrol crisis would only last 10 days, so it's lasted longer than 10 days, certainly in London. Every garage I've passed, petrol station I've passed for the last 3 drives has been closed every single time. How is anyone in London? How are there any cars moving in London? I don't understand it. Get an electric car, like I've got, that's what I say, but... get an electric car, that's good. My books, I've got 2 books out at the same time. One of them's out right now for the people here, but if you listen to this home, they're both out. Richard Herring's Would You Rather and the paperback version, The Problem With Men, out on November the 4th, just in time for International Men's Day, and whenever that is. So buy both of those. My book, Would You Rather, this week was number 1 in the Amazon snooker chart. Yeah, it was ahead of the Queen's Gambit. And think how much snooker there must be in that. So very exciting. I think there is one question about snooker in my... Maybe it finds the word snooker in your book and it's about... So I don't know. I may be wrong. And I've been thinking about this... I don't know if it's because I'm exercising a bit or...
But I've realised that over the last 30 years, I've been thinking about a man that I just walked past. I heard him say two sentences, and I still think about him very regularly. I'm going to try and tell this story succinctly, but we'll see how it goes. It was like the early 1990s, and I was in Richmond, and I'd met up with some university friends to play rounders. That's how long ago it was. I wish I could play rounders again. I think it was the last time I ever played rounders. I remember rounders. Does anyone play rounders anymore? I don't even know how you play it anymore, but it feels like something from the last millennium, because it was. Anyway, we arrived at the park, and it was quite arrogant to play rounders in a park, I think, like with other people, right? We hadn't booked anywhere. But there was an even more assured and confident group of young people who were there to play frisbee with each other, okay? They weren't on our patch or anything, so I guess it was a big park, I don't know. But they seemed brasher and posher and more confident than us, though I have to say, I think we must have had a degree of cocksuredness ourselves to take over a chunk of public land to play a children's game that I loved. Who wants to play rounders right now? I do. Anyone want to? Should we go out and play rounders in Leicester Square? The guy I remember, who I'd thought about regularly for the last three decades, even though as far as I know this is the only time our paths have crossed, was limbering up ahead of a game of frisbee, properly stretching like he was an athlete. I think he had long hair and an Alice band, but I might be imagining that. He was addressing his group of friends in a casual, friendly way, but with a tinge of self-importance and arrogance, and he said, "Come on, guys, stretch those hammies. I don't want any pulled hammies today." Think about that. Honestly, at least once a month. Struck me as utterly ridiculous that a group of people in their early 20s would stretch before playing a game of frisbee. It was definitely a casual weekend thing, not a professional frisbee event, but I think stretching before a professional frisbee event would be overkill. And looks like, you'll be looking slightly ashamed that you were involved. It would be a better pre-game ritual. I also wondered how many people ever pulled a hamstring playing frisbee in the park with their friends. It won't be none, but it won't be many. That is what I was... Not enough to insist on warming up and making yourself the centre of attention. People's hamstrings are their own concern. If you want them to warm up, that's their business, not yours. They don't need a so-called friend instructing them how to do it. Just seemed attention-seeking and prickish to me. I did not warm up my hammies before playing rounders or at any point in my exercising life, including when I ran the marathon. I suspect he's in the back of mine because I am running again from ahead of my half marathon. This sentence was all I heard from him as we were walking past. An interesting, isn't the rightness or wrongness of him instructing his friends to stretch in faux concern for their hamstrings whilst just trying to make himself appear like the alpha male of some frisbeers? But I've never been able to forget him, and he keeps popping into my mind. And now, because this is on the podcast, it's been immortalised in a podcast that is archived in the British Museum and the British Library. And so his arseholery might be read, listened to and read about in hundreds of years' time. That was the only mark left by him on humanity. Be that. If you're listening to this hammies guy, and calling them hammies is obviously part of what made them comedic too, their hamstrings. What have you been up to recently? Do you want to play rounders? We should stretch now. We're in our 50s. Anyway, weird. It was just weird that I remembered that. And I'm wearing my wedding suit today. This is 10 years. I still fit into my wedding suit event. The reason it looks okay is because I didn't fit into it for most of my marriage. I also bought some boots online. Like that, look at those. But they were on sale and I didn't really look at them properly. And they've got quite a big heel on them, have you noticed? It's pretty good. I'm taller than my wife when I wear this. As long as she isn't wearing any shoes. I might just wear them all the time. She looked at me in a different way now. She had to look slightly up. I didn't buy them, so I could be tall. I didn't know I'd be tall. Anyway, my guest this week is probably best known for his appearance on South Today on the 8th of October 2018. That's why we're all here today. Was that when Bill Grundy on South Today? I'll find out. Will you please welcome the amazing Dave Gorman, ladies and gentlemen. It's David Gorman. Thanks, Dave Gorman. Come here. Sit down. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm all right, thank you. Good. Yeah.
Good.
I thought you were looking taller.
Yeah, I've grown. Yeah. Look at that. Amazing. Look at that. It's quite extreme, isn't it?
It is extreme. Simon Cowell wears similar lifts. But pretending you didn't deliberately
I
buy
didn't.
Lifts.
I bought some other boots with the normal heel, and then at the last minute I thought, I should get some black ones to wear
with my
suit.
You bought some lifts. You got them. You thought, oh, fuck, this is so obvious. I'm going to have to pretend I didn't do it on purpose. I thought they were going to be subtle and I'd get away with it.
If it's so obvious, how come you didn't spot them in the dressing room? Right, South today. What was South today? The where Bill was that the Bill where Bill Grundy used to be on that
I've,
before?
I've no idea. Oh. I think it was probably Fred Dinage.
Yeah,
at one point.
Yeah. Who was it? Who interviewed you on South today on the 8th of October 2018?
I can't remember his name.
Okay,
but and I'm guessing because I think I've only been on South today once. I wouldn't have even known I was...
According to IMDb.
I wouldn't have known the name of the show I was on, but...
Like so the Sex Pistols, you've only been on once, and that's because... Like the Sex Pistols.
I moved to Bournemouth. In March, it'll have been 4 years that we've been in Bournemouth. And on my last tour, there was a bunch of material about basically being bombarded by messages from people on Twitter, are you retired then? And everyone assuming it's a retirement home place and whatever, and responses to that and statistics about that and so on. And I was warming the tour up in a little venue in Andover, and a guy who works for South Today, is that
South Today?
Was
don't
in the audience.
Pretend you wasn't the highlight of your...
he was in the audience, and he was like, oh my God, somebody has moved to our region. We should talk to him about that. And so they said, can we do an interview with you about that? And I went, no. And they went, oh, go on. And I went, you can if it's broadcast a week before my tour dates in the region.
Yeah.
And they went, all right then. And so I sat down with the man and he said, so why have you moved to Bournemouth? And I said, because it's lovely. And he went, oh, that's nice. And people pretended it was exciting that someone had chosen to eschew London in favour of Bournemouth.
It was quite exciting. I mean, it's exciting if you live in Bournemouth.
I don't think me living in Bournemouth is exciting for the people of Bournemouth. I love living there. It's absolutely lovely, and I see more of my family, and my child has more time outdoors, and we go to the beach a lot, and it's... I'm loving living there. It's fantastic. But I don't understand how that could possibly give pleasure to others, just knowing that I'm a neighbour, sort of.
Do a lot of people gawp at you in the street when they see you walk past?
No. Hmm. No, they don't.
They're playing it very cool, but that's inside.
I was on there to discuss moving to the region.
Yeah.
And weirdly, and I this is what I don't understand, because it was for like regional TV news. It was, you know, an item on the end of the local news.
Yeah.
And the local when I lived in London, the local news was fucking terrible because the local news was the same as the news.
Yeah.
So you'd sort of watch the national news and then they'd go, and now some things that happen in London. It's the news. Because all the politicians are in London and all that. So there wouldn't be very much like properly local content. And I sort of looked forward to the idea of living somewhere where the local news would actually be local news. And God, that's even worse. Because it's really, I mean, I don't, they don't light it very well. It's like, no, there's no money being put into what's on screen. And it's just somebody visited a school.
Yeah.
And just...
Are you a bit annoyed that you weren't the headline? Is that what you're
saying? No, I'm not.
Dave Gorman has moved into the area.
What's
15 minutes.
Really weird is it was the number one trending story on the BBC News website.
Right.
So I was on tour in Coventry, I think, and I got a load of calls and messages from mates going, why are you telling the world you've moved to Bournemouth? Because it was the top story of all the stories that have been read on the BBC News website for a day was a comedian you probably haven't heard of has moved. I don't know how that happened, but some algorithm threw me to the top of a thing.
Well, you're very popular. People like to know where you are. Well, good. It is very nice in Bournemouth. I visited you in Bournemouth, and it's delightful.
It is.
I've visited you in London as well, and it was all right as well. it wasn't as nice.
No, it is. It's a very nice part of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, now that's going to be a...
It's going to be back on the BBC News now. Once this goes out.
Well, they weirdly take snippets from these interviews and put them in the Metro or the Mirror. That's not going to make it, is it?
There's a journalist
Dave
watching.
Dave Foreman said it's lovely in Bournemouth.
Now we're live streaming. The journalists don't even have to bother coming to these gigs. They just have to pay £10. Someone's writing this up now. Look, yes, I've made £25. Minus the £10 for the stream. £15 profit. We're right in. So, look, well, seeing we're talking about being boring and moving out of London, even more boringly, you now write crosswords.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was me denying that moving to Bournemouth was like retiring. And 3 years later, I'm writing cryptic crosswords for the newspapers.
How did this happen? How did you get into crime? I know you've always enjoyed...
Yeah, well, I've always done them. I sort of taught myself to do them when I was a teenager. And someone who sort of travels and whatever, I like having a cryptic crossword with me. It's like having a friend for company through the day on a train or whatever. And it's always been a part of my life. And I wrote about them in one of my books, and that led to me writing the foreword for a book of cryptic crosswords by The Observer a few years ago. So I've always had these little sort of connections with some of the people involved in that world. And at the time back then, when I wrote that foreword, I sort of dabbled with writing clues, but I wasn't really brave enough to do anything with it. And then during the first lockdown, I sort of wrote a crossword, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I figured, well, I did that because I'm bored in lockdown, and there must be lots of other people who are bored in lockdown, and maybe some of those people would like to do a crossword. So I tweeted it, and the crossword editor of The Independent replied to my tweet saying, some really good clues here, but the grid's shit. And I wrote back to him saying, if I did one where the grid wasn't shit, would you be interested?
What can I ask, what makes a grid shitter than another grid?
No, seeing as you find crosswords boring, you may not ask that. Because that belies an interest that you are denying exists, Richard Herring. Is it boring or do you want to know?
I want to know. I'm getting interested. Yeah. Also, journalists are going to be writing, crosswords are my friend, Dave Gorman. That's what you worry. I've got two fantastic scoops already. Yeah. When I have no friends, I have crosswords. So, what makes a good grid, Dave?
A good grid is about the number of crossing letters in the words. So what you shouldn't have...
Yeah, so it shouldn't just be a load of words
you shouldn't
that
have
don't
a load
cross
of...
over each yeah. in a line.
You shouldn't really have more than two consecutive uncrossed squares in a word.
Wow.
And ideally, every answer would have 50% of its content crossing with other words.
That sounds tough.
That's what was wrong with it.
Yeah.
So I got in touch with that editor, and he ended up publishing one. And then I wrote a load more for him. And now in The Independent, most months, twice a month. Mm-hmm. And in The Guardian every couple of months, and in The Telegraph once a month, which has become weird. That's basically...
£10,000 a crossword?
It is so ridiculously badly paid. and I worry that people would perceive that as me going, used to my showbiz riches, it is probably... It's shit. Regardless, basically every other crossword setter, there's about three people in the country who make a living writing crosswords, and almost all the other crossword setters in the country, it's their hobby. Mm-hmm. It's no one's job, really. Right. So that
tells
you what you need to know about
the money.
Those
three are kind of like billionaire crosswords. But don't the crossword, actually, a lot of people buy newspapers, especially now, people buy the physical newspaper for the crossword, right?
Yeah. I mean, a million people a day do one, I think, in Britain. So there's still a lot of people doing them. I think Paul, his real name's John Halpin, is sort of like the most prolific. He sets for all the broadsheets, and he's one of the ones who makes a living at it. And when he was younger, he was a massive fan of the Reverend John Graham, I think his real name was, who was Araucaria, who was like the legendary Guardian setter of the day. And John and the two Johns got in touch, and John Halpin, the young man at university wanted to become crossword setter, got invited to lunch by Arrow Carrier, and he picked him up at the station. And John describes, I think it was like getting into a battered old Mini and realising, oh, this is not a good course in life. This is the most highly regarded crossword setter there has ever been. And he's driving a 15-year-old shit Mini.
When a crossword setter invites another crossword setter to lunch, do they do it with a cryptic clue to say where it's going to be and what time it's going to be?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't realise I'm constantly inviting you out to social events.
You've just been missing them.
The invitations have existed.
So, and also, I want to know why do crossword setters? I'm going to just talk about crosswords for now. I think we can do it.
Okay.
Why do crossword setters have to not just use their actual names? Why does a bloke called John call himself Paul? That's not even that different, you know. Not even like an exciting name.
No, it's not. And in that instance, and I'm only doing this because it's you, I'm going to pull the rug from under you because he's called himself Paul in honour of his dead brother. So now you feel shit. But
why bring his dead brother down by pretending he does crosswords?
I don't know why people have to have pseudonyms, but it's part of the thing. So when I was younger, when Sudoku became big, whatever, like every time the Sudoku printed in the paper, there was a little paragraph at the side of it saying all the numbers 1 to 9 fit in every row and every button, and there was a little explanation of how the puzzle works so that anyone could look at it and go, oh, right, and try and begin solving it. And cryptic crosswords, and it's not a thing I like about them, they are opaque and they seem to enjoy the idea that a beginner would look at it and go, well, that makes no fucking sense. I don't get it.
Yeah.
When I was like 13, 14, it was seeing something in the paper that made no sense really annoyed me. And so I started holding on to yesterday's newspaper and looking at the answers the next day and going, why is that? And I sort of worked it out for myself through sheer determination to not understand something. And I think the crossword world would benefit itself by being a bit more open and sharing more of how it works. And I think the pseudonyms is all part of that cloak and dagger bullshit.
Yeah.
And that makes it feel like a world that's not for you, even though it is for you. I know, like, one of the things... There are some people, like everything, in the world of comedy, there's sort of chortle and what they think of you is important, and even though it's not important in the wider world. And in crosswords, there are blogs that review every single broadsheet crossword and what the 50 people who comment on that is seen as really important. And it's not fucking important because there's a million people doing them and only 50 people on this website, and that's not actually that important. But amongst those people, there are some people who really like me, and there are a couple of people who hate me with a passion. And I don't know, it's partly because they see me as an outsider who shouldn't have been allowed in, and I've been welcomed in, and it's partly because I'm a little bit earthier than some... People who don't do cryptic crosswords think it's all about Greek gods and Roman things and opera and Wagner and knowing all those sort of things, and I'll do clues about Beyonce and Pooh and Wee.
Yeah.
And the people who want it to all be about opera and Greek gods really hate me doing clues about poo.
So the poo comes down in the O of Beyonce, P, and we.
Not poo and Beyonce.
Okay.
I haven't yet included poo and Beyonce.
Okay, all right.
But I have done clues about Beyonce and clues about Pooh separately.
Good.
Yeah.
So you say you don't like the pseudonyms, but you've got loads of them.
Well, I've got three of them because you have to have one.
Okay.
For them.
And so, how did you choose your names?
Well, The Independent, I am Bluth, B-L-U-T-H. And that is because in Gaelic, Gorm is blue and Anne is the.
Right.
And so Gorman is blue the, and I took the E's off because it made a nicer word. And also, I'm a really big fan of Arrested Development.
Okay.
And I was eating a frozen banana at the time. So that seemed like a good idea.
Okay.
In the Telegraph, I'm Django.
Okay.
And that's David, James and Gorman, which is my name sort of condensed. And in The Guardian, I'm Fed. And in American slang, a Fed would be also a G-man. So like the FBI are Feds or G-men, and I'm a G-man. So cool. That did that.
Yeah.
There you go. Is that happy now?
Yeah, I'm very happy. Did it make you happy when you came up with those? Yeah. I'm going to be Fed.
No, you just have to have one. What would yours be, Richard?
Mine would be... I tried to come up with a pseudonym for writing, right? Which I don't think I'm ever going to do because I thought people don't take me seriously as a writer because I'm a comedian. So I might come up with a pseudonym for writing. What did I come up with? It was Rufus.
Who do you think you are? Rufus.
Well, because I thought, like, would I get like
J.K. Rowling?
Would I get like a novel published? If you send it as Richard Herring, then you know they're going nah. But if you send it in as I think I came up with something like Rufus for Red and the Spanish for Herring, which I can't remember what it was now, but it was far enough away from Herring. So I'd probably do something around Red Herring.
Right.
And then my name's Herring.
Oh, yeah.
And also Richard begins with R. So it's R Herring.
I love the idea that you think it would be somehow easier to get a novel published if you were unknown. It's like you haven't been awake in the world for the last... It'd
be easier for me. But I think, you know, it's interesting because a crossword clue is sort of like a really annoying joke. They're like jokes, but you have to work them out and then go, So it's sort of like I think as a comedian, they're witty. Your clues are very witty, I think.
I think some of them might qualify as that.
Which is when it's there are those clues and crosswords that you kind of go, that is very nice. That's what are your favourite of your own or other people's clues that are those sort of witty?
Too high a bar to set, isn't it? Because now I've got my answer is supposed to be witty.
Well.
But will also need to be explained.
Yeah, but it also doesn't have to be that funny because it's still a crossword clue.
That's true. Well, so... The worst thing you can say to a crossword setter and the thing that people always say is, bloody hell, it's like 3-2 bloody 1, mate. Which I know is a very old reference, but I still said every time I publish a crossword, somebody says that to me. For those young people who don't know it, 3-2-1 was an ITV game show in the 80s, hosted by Ted Rogers, and the contestants would be given clues throughout the game. Yeah, that's it. And 3-2-1. I think it was Un, Dos, Tres on Spanish TV before it was on British TV. Anyway, they'd do sort of like variety acts, and at the end of each act, they'd give a clue and put it on the table. It'd be a physical object and also some written text. And they would have to try and work out what it was a clue to, and they'd whittle it down until they had one clue left, and that was their prize. And the booby prize was Dusty Bin, and the star prize be a holiday or a caravan or a car or whatever. And the clues made no sense, deliberately made no sense, were packed with ambiguity and had no correct answer. So somebody would give them a physical object, it would be like a key, and the clue would say, it's got wheels. It'll take you away. You'll be packing your bags for this one. And you go, oh, we think it's this one, Ted. We think it's going to be a holiday. And they go, well, it's got wheels. A car's got wheels. A caravan's got wheels. But Dusty Bin's got wheels. Oh, it'll take you away. You could get taken away in a bin, couldn't you? You'll be packing your bin bags. They're bin bags. It's Dusty Bin. And no clue had a correct answer. Like, you could absolutely invent two different realities for every single clue. And nobody in the entire... You might guess correctly what it was. You might say, I think it's a car, and it would be the car. But you wouldn't have given the explanation that Ted then gave when he read the monologue that came with it. Whereas cryptic crossword clues... have a correct answer. Every word is employed in it. And at the beginning or end of the clue is just the same as a quick crossword clue. Mm-hmm. There's an actual definition in it. So you can't cheat. You can't have it mean one thing or another thing or whatever, because you actually have to have the same as a normal crossword clue built into it. So, for example, one of mine that upset a few people was... C7 are made poorly, eating supermarket crabs, for example.
Okay.
Okay. So, and this is very hard to do just in your head. It's much easier to explain if you can write stuff down. But take the letters in the words C7R and now make them poorly. So you make an anagram of the words C7R. And then that anagram is eating a supermarket.
Right.
And that supermarket is Aldi, A-L-D-I. And if you put that in the middle of an anagram of C7R, you get venereal disease. Which is crabs, for example. So if it was a quick crossword clue, it would say crabs, for example, and the answer would be venereal disease, and you wouldn't think that was impossible. You'd get some crossword, you'd work it out. But you've got all this help to help you work it out.
Yeah.
And the people who were upset with it were upset for two reasons. One, that it's venereal disease, but two, it was fucking Aldi. Like, that's lowering the tones of crosswords already before we get to the answer, mate. So they don't like me being a bit sort of common.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's good you're kicking up in the cross world.
Well, it's also it's like we last time I was here, or maybe one time I was here with you, we talked about it. It makes me giggle so much. There was a review from some Newcastle comedy website that I got, which we couldn't read. Neither of us could read it with a straight face.
Oh, yes.
It's something about if Frankie Boyle is the Mick Jagger of comedy, Dave Gorman is the Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was a really odd thesis that the guy had. But I'm not a bad boy of comedy. So it's kind of fun being the bad boy of crosswords.
That became like a running question. I can't quite remember what happened, but I remember someone writing in and they thought that Mick Jagger was Muck Jagger. So they wrote in an answer to the question, I think, with like an essay about it, but called it Mick Jagger, Muck Jagger. So they were listening up thinking, Frankie Boyle is the Muck Jagger.
I've not got to the bottom of it.
No.
But yeah, no, so I'm a sort of, you know, I'm a clean-cut, nice boy of comedy, but filthy in crossword by their standards.
Very good.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Good. You are still being a comedian, though. Though not through lockdown, obviously, so much, but you've come back and are working on a new show.
I did three new material nights in Clapham to find myself, you know, enjoy it again. And I really, really enjoyed it. And there's sort of a tour in there. I just don't know when that's going to happen. It's all, as much like you basically have to book a tour about a year in advance. And at the moment, all the theatres are full of all the people whose tours got cancelled the first time.
Yeah.
So there's this backlog of people sort of getting out of it. And also, I've spent 2 years at home with my wife and son, and it's really nice. I kind of like it.
Yeah.
So maybe I have retired to Bournemouth to write cryptic crosswords in a shed. I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to tour at some point, but I don't know when.
And it's still, you're still with the, doing the PowerPoint stuff within this show. That's because you've always, throughout your career, you've sort of reinvented yourself quite regularly, I think.
Yeah.
You started out doing poetry and...
Yeah,
and spoken, you know, and then you've moved through these different.
Yeah, there've been sort of like three incarnations, yeah. I think of it, but that's because I get bored, and want to do new stuff. But no, the PowerPoint stuff with it, I'm still excited by, and it's still interesting to me, and it still allows me to do jokes about things I can't do just verbally, and it's like having a double act, but I don't have to pay my partner. Because I can be saying this, you know, it's a classic thick trope of comedy. You're saying one thing but meaning another. I can be saying one thing and the screen can be proving me wrong behind me or whatever. We can literally have interplay between me and it.
Yeah.
And I think normally in an hour and a half show, I run through about 600 to 700 slides. So I'm literally sort of, it's changing every 20 seconds or something. It's like, it's a constant to and fro between me and it. Which I really like, and I don't know how to replace that. That sort of feels like a really useful device. Still.
Is it cheating to have interplay with your with your screen during a show? Is that cheating on your partner, or is it you're allowed to have interplay with PowerPoint?
Do you know what the word interplay means? Sounds like you don't know what the word interplay means.
I might be making up my own definitions. So you don't know whether that's so you've done some a couple of gigs post.
I've done three gigs post lockdown and they were really exciting to be back. It was really it's just nice to be out of the house. But it was they were really really good fun. I really liked it. And there's sort of 30 or 40 minutes of it in particular that I thought I really want to tour that. That's really fun to do. It's got a sort of I don't know, a quality to it straight out of the gate. Normally you do new stuff and you go, I can work on that. There's something in that. And there was about 30 minutes of it where I'd thought, oh, that's ready. I could just do it. And that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Because I was like...
That's enough. Pad that out.
The magic trick, isn't it? And then there's an hour of other stuff, which I know is nearly there and is
just
right. And
do some crosswords for an hour. Just put them up and don't move to the next one until everyone's worked it out. But they're not allowed to. They're not allowed to talk
no
to
conferring.
Each other.
No conferring.
You get kicked out. Yeah. I think you can make it work.
Yeah. I will do it. I just don't know when to do it because there's this sort of.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the chaos to sort of move through the theatres and stuff.
Yeah. But. Did you sort of, it sounds like you sort of enjoyed lockdown, you know, aside from the people dying and all that sort of stuff. That was sad.
That was sad, yeah.
We're alive though, right? So we got through it.
I think enjoyed is pushing it.
Okay.
I sort of think, I think this is true for a lot of people, I'm a bit nostalgic for the first lockdown.
Right.
That was all right. At the time, later on, My boy was in school and we were doing homeschooling and it was harder. But in the first lockdown, he was in nursery, so we were paddling pool in the garden and it was quite nice. And he sort of also reached an age where he could go for a 3 or 4 mile walk, which he'd never really been able to do until then. And that was just sort of, it was kind of, there's stuff to enjoy about that first lockdown. The bad stuff is that he didn't see another child for about 3 months. Mm. And so he played with us differently because I'd sort of got used to the idea that sometimes playing with him means being in the same room as him while he plays. Yeah. But that wasn't good enough when he didn't have children to play with. So he started doing this thing of sort of, I go, right, I'm a dinosaur and you're my egg. I'm going to lay you. Okay, fine. And then you sort of curl yourself up on the living room floor and he'd sit on you and go, I'm laying you now. Laying you now. And you'd come out of it going, and he'd go, no, Daddy, you're doing it wrong. I go, well, how am I doing it wrong? We're long necks. No, you're doing it wrong. And he'd get really angry with me. And when you see kids playing with each other in role play like this, they sort of muddle along with it and they'll make up their own rules as they go. But a grown-up can't do it. You just can't do it. It was like being a member of an impro troupe where the boss was constantly furious. And we're just dying for him to meet other children and get that out of his system with them instead of with us. And so when we did one of the later lockdowns and he was then in school, and we were doing the homeschooling, one of his best friends from school, his parents have got two kids and they've both got full-time jobs and they're both working from home and they were in a real tough situation. And they're also doing things like they're teaching their 9-year-old French and neither of them speak French. And it's like you've reached a level where you're actually teaching, even at nine, you're teaching them stuff you don't know.
Yeah.
Which at least wasn't the case in reception. You know, I could handle the homeschooling there. And we got in touch with his best mate's parents and said, can we have your boy one day a week? We'll take him off your hands.
Right.
Because we'll homeschool two kids and we'll just not do the homeschooling that day. We'll let them play. It'll be great. And we'll have a nice time and it'll be easier for him. And we put so much social capital in the bank because we asked for nothing in return. We appeared to be angels saying, we will take one of your children off your hands one day a week, free of charge, gratis, nothing required in return. And they were so bloody grateful. But so were we, because we had this other boy on Tuesdays and he could be a fucking egg. And that's a weight off our mind and shoulders, literally. And and we've had favours in return. You know, our boys, since things have lifted, but he's had a sleepover at there so we can have a night out. And we've basically got endless capital in the bank with that couple. They don't realise quite how over a barrel they are now. Yeah.
Hopefully they're not listening to the podcast. Oh, Gorman! The Gormans! Why have you done that? I'm going to ask you some. Would you rather? Look, I've got a would you rather question that isn't the book. This is just based on, like, you know, I don't know if my mind's just addling as I get old, right? And I talked about the other week. I was moving logs. I got a log delivery for our fire. That's where we are now, writing crosswords and getting logs. I was throwing the logs into the log store and trying, it's sort of like a game of Tetris. I thought it might be quite a good Taskmaster game if you can get them into the gaps. But then I started thinking of things from the perspective of the logs, right? If you were a log, if you were a log that was meant to be burnt on a fire, would you rather be at the back of the log store, like deep in where you're not going to get picked out very soon, or at the front of the log store where you get... So I would just think from a... Do you think the logs want to be burned or do you think they want to... Do they want to stay at the back of the log store?
I think if the log is sentient...
Yeah.
It probably most wants to be a tree. I think we've already crossed the Rubicon from the log's point of view. When it was that cut down sailed. And logged.
Yeah.
Given that...
What if the log became sentient once the tree was cut into bits?
In that instance...
And it's meant to be a firewood log, but does it want to live as a log and be at the back and maybe... Because what happens when another log delivery comes and the ones at the back pretty much stay at the back forever?
Then I imagine, in this scenario...
Yeah.
Where logs become sentient when they're chopped up and turned into logs.
Yeah.
Then the logs become sentient at the point at which their destiny is to be burned, and they are showbiz logs that want to be fucking burned, and they want to be at the front
that
doing their job.
See, it says a lot about you, that answer. Yeah. That was good. Yeah. It says a lot about the people. That one didn't make the book. Because, you know, I came up with it more recently. It would be all the book. Would you rather be sent to Coventry or have the scent of Coventry?
How long am I sent to Coventry for?
Well, I mean, is it literal or figurative? You can decide that yourself. I'd say it was a permanent thing. You're either sent to Coventry, either literally or figuratively, or you smell of Coventry forever.
I'd smell of Coventry forever. Yeah. I don't know that anyone has ever, in a blind smell test, identified Coventry. I don't feel like that's a thing.
I don't think it would be a nice smell. It would be all the scents of Coventry.
All of them.
Well, they'd all be and then distilled into one scent. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be so powerful as like a concentrated smell of everything in Coventry, but it would be the distilled. They'd put everything in Coventry that smelt in a smell chamber and whisk it all together, and then they'd spray that onto you and you would have the scent of Coventry.
I mean, it feels like it would be hard to do this without destroying Coventry. And they tried that once, Rich. And I don't think we're on their side.
Coventry rose from the flame. You can't destroy it. It comes back stronger. I remember that. It's one of my earliest memories is going to Coventry Cathedral and that big picture of the mural of Jesus on the wall of it. Absolutely fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
And it put the fear. Do you know the picture? There's like a massive thing of just Jesus. I'm looking at it again. It's not as bad as I remember it being. It's not as scary, but I was absolutely...
But did you believe in Jesus then?
Yeah, I think so. And he looked, and he was big, and he was coming off the wall at me, and
yeah.
And then he already destroyed one cathedral behind the one he was in. He was coming for another one. Coventry's nice. I'm not having a go at Coventry, though. I will never gig inside of Coventry.
I bet you play the University of Warwick.
I have, but it's far enough away.
It's not. The postcode is CV4, for fuck's sake. University of Warwick, postcode CV4. It's in fucking Coventry.
It's far enough away. This is towards the end of the book. When I was running out...
Oh, no, don't read it. I don't want to know how it ends.
When I was running out of ideas. Would you rather be able to fart the Blockbusters theme tune or own a cat? Got to do another 20 of them. Let's put that one out.
Well, I mean, I do own a cat.
Yeah.
Would I have to give up my cat?
Yeah.
Oh.
But you'd be able to fart the blood. And I imagine when it's that, it's the entire thing as well. So it's not
have
just.
To be.
Yeah. It's not just like. And then you'd run out, you'd be. And in tune and harmonies and stuff.
And would I never be allowed another cat?
Your cat would be taken away. You mainly killed. And you wouldn't
this
be
is tricky because our cat went missing for 5 weeks this year. It was very traumatic, and we were very upset. And then she was found, and because she's tagged, we got her back. So I've sensed, touched the grief of losing a cat. But fuck it, I'd have the Blockbusters.
Yeah, I would as well.
I think, I mean, to be able to fart something that would make everyone of a certain generation hand jive. Would be a remarkable party piece. And anyone who could fart the theme tune to Blockbusters and couldn't parlay that into untold riches doesn't deserve the gift.
I agree. I think you would... I don't know if the Raw Variety... It would definitely be in the Raw Variety performance 1 year. There isn't enough TV shows. In the old days, there were TV shows where someone who could do something like that would just crop up on them every now and again when they...
Play a mule train with a tea tray on their head. That guy.
And they wouldn't have to do anything else. Yeah. They'd just have their one thing and they could... And then you'd play all the theatres. But I don't know if that's got...
I feel like you'd absolutely blitz week one on Britain's Got Talent. But then have nothing left of the final. I mean, it's a guaranteed golden buzzer on week one. And then normally people are coming back with bigger and better acts and you're just... have to reincarnate Bob Holness to try and add something to it.
All right, we'll do one more and we'll get back to the proper questions. Hold on. This is interesting. This is a showbiz question for you. Would you rather be a mime or one of those people who pretends to be a statue? If you had to work outdoors...
Oh...
It's not a nice choice, Dave.
No, I'll go with the mime.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you get to move around a bit.
Yeah. I did do some street theatre once.
Yeah, that's why I thought.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
I thought you did some juggling or something.
No, I did street theatre once.
Oh, right, okay.
And it was awful.
What did you do in your act? Was it mine?
I did it with a mate of mine.
Okay.
We had met a really brilliant street artist guy called Pepe, who did this workshop with us. And he was an amazing bloke, travelled around the world. I think he lived in Coventry.
Okay.
Actually. Very fragrant man. He sort of lived this weird itinerant life because he was a mime, and so his act worked internationally, and he'd just travel the world. This month was Montreal, this month was Edinburgh, this month was here, you know, like literally did that. And he'd go back home once a year and almost always get his wife pregnant and then go back off on the road. It was a really weird, I was like 14 when I met him. He was really sort of engaging and funny and interesting. And a mate of mine, Seymour and I tried doing an act one time. We were two of the people from the workshop who actually had the cojones to go, all right, we'll give it a go.
Yeah.
And it's really hard without a roof and trying to get people to stop and whatever. We sort of mirrored... we mirrored an existing sort of street act where people would get a member of the audience out and they would juggle things past their face. But we did it with that person blindfold and the audience in on the joke that we weren't doing that.
Okay.
So one person thought we were on unicycles juggling heavy things right past their face. Well, actually, we were rushing our fingers in front of his face like that and trying to make an audience laugh at the idea that this person thought it was real.
Okay.
Which sort of worked on a very small level, but we never got... the crowd to the tipping point you need to make money doing that. So we then gave up and went home.
Oh, that's a good idea, though. Yeah. I like the thought behind it.
We worked with the idea that we couldn't do all any of the actual stuff. I can juggle a little, but not that.
It's a good way to improve. If you can get everyone to keep the pretense up forever, it's a good way to make one person think you're amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a shame you didn't see that.
There might well be one person who still thinks it happened to him. I don't know. But that was what we did.
I was thinking about both of us, and we've had a sort of similar-ish sort of career in many ways, and I was wondering if there's any other point in history you and I could have made a living doing what we do. We're sort of essentially sort of playing and doing, you know, and trying crazy stuff out and doing it, and a lot of your stuff obviously is big, big commitments in terms of going around the world and finding all these different people. Do you think there's another time in history, if you hadn't been born in the 60s or 70s of the last century to now, that you could have lived the sort of lived and made a living from the sort of things that you and also I
probably not, but it's probably not just the time, it's also the place. I would think like Britain is particularly uniquely placed for that. I don't know that there's anything similar happening in other parts of Western Europe, even. There's something of Britain's relationship with comedy is different.
Yes.
And stuff. And America is different again. I don't think it could survive in any other ecosystem, let alone time.
Yeah.
No, I'd have to invent PowerPoint first as well. It'd be tricky.
But even for some of the things that you did... like the internet would have and the technology would have ruined. I mean, the Dave Gorman, Are You Dave Gorman, would sort of been ruined, wouldn't it? The first step if the internet had been a bigger thing.
People now conflate Googlebug Adventure and Are You Dave Gorman. So I get lots of messages still from people who think I Googled all my namesakes because they've confused those two things. Whereas actually Are You Dave Gorman, like I say, it actually sort of exists at a moment kind of almost just before Google becomes the go-to resource that it now is.
Yeah.
It's the reason I said no to a sequel to that is the first series was a thing that had actually happened and then got turned into a TV show.
Yeah.
And then the idea of doing it with the backing of a TV company again, we go, well, there'd be no Jeopardy.
Yeah.
We'd just get a research and we'd find them all. And there wouldn't be... It was a story about how we went from one to another. And series two would be, and then we got some other people to do all that. And I thought, that's shit. Yeah. That's not engaging to me. So, and like you say, if Google had just been there and you'd been able to go, well, we found all of them. That's not a story. No. And it's about that, not about who they are or who I am or anything. It's about where we went and why. So, yeah, I'm not interested
but
you, in that.
But it's sort of always interesting about that those shows from that time, even the Reasons to Be Cheerful one was that it was the you allowed it was about the adventure more than about what the title of the show was. So you allowed you allowed that to
I think of all the things I've done, that's the biggest leap in the dark. That's the beginning of all the other things that I've had any kind of success with was that one, and that was I've been going up to Edinburgh two or three times, and I'm sure audiences don't give a shit, and I don't think comedians should moan about it, but essentially a lot of people just go up and lose a lot of money in Edinburgh. It's so expensive. It's such a competitive field. You can sell out. And the first time I did a one-man show in Edinburgh, if I'd sold every single ticket, I would have lost $4,000. And that's the economics of Edinburgh. Yeah. Certainly how it was. It's worse now.
It's worse now.
Yeah. Although there's also the free fringe, and things have come to sort of combat that, and that sort of didn't exist when we were starting there. So that was the reality of it. And I just thought there's something really perverse about this whole industry going to this city for a month to watch you. I lived in Manchester at the time, but I was on the, you know, coming down and doing London gigs quite a lot. And the purpose of Edinburgh effectively was to lose money but hopefully be seen by a TV executive. And I said, well, but I'm gigging in Islington and in Crouch End. I'm gigging 5 minutes from their house and not losing money. Why have we all got to go there to lose money, to have them see me do that thing they could have seen me do 5 minutes from their house? Sure. And I have a very sort of distinct and very fond memory of sitting with my manager and saying, I think Edinburgh's fucked. I think if I'm going to risk all that money, I should be doing something creatively risky as well. I don't want to do my club act. I want to create a show for this that I don't know if it's good or not. I want to find out whether I can do something different. And him getting really sort of twitchy about it. And all I had was, I said, I want to do a show about the lyrics to Ian Dury's song Reasons to Be Cheerful. And he said, have you thought about doing one about a more popular song? I'm not interested. That's not the point. It's the not knowing how that will go is what excites me. I'm not going to go and lose $5,000 doing something that earns me a living the rest of the year. I want to take a creative risk. And he said, right, well, let's get previews as early as we can so we can find out. And then you can not put yourself in the brochure if it's too weird or something. So I did a gig at Battersea Arts Centre. And I hadn't really written the whole show. And I was prepared to sort of go, well, I've written this bit and I'll have to tell the audience there's a gap here, but I'm going to get to these lyrics and I'll get through it. And I started, and I sort of, basically, my reasoning was there's about 57 reasons to be cheerful in the song, and I thought I'll do a bit of material about each of them. Once you've done that and told the punter to turn the phone off in the 16th minute, said hello and goodbye, that's probably an hour, that'll be okay. And again, this is kind of before the internet. You couldn't Google the lyrics, and they're quite hard to hear, and I'd tried finding them in different ways, and at one point, I went to the British Library to find a copy of Smash Hits, and it was the one that was missing. And then on my way back home to Manchester, I stopped at my mum's in Stafford, and I found the copy of the magazine I'd been looking for in my childhood bedroom. I'd owned it all along. So I found the lyrics and things. So when I did the preview show in Battersea, the very first one, it was like a hostage situation. It lasted over 2 hours. And when I got to the gaps in the story and I started explaining, I was like, look, the reason I haven't got this bit is I couldn't work out what the lyrics were in verse two. But to find them out, I did this and I went here and I did this and I went there and I went to the British Library and this happened. Then on my way home, I found that. Like, and that was getting bigger laughs than all the jokes I'd written in the first bit. And it was like, it was way too long, and it wasn't, I'm not pretending it was a great gig, but the audience were engaged in it for the full 2 hours. Like, the audience were not going, oh, fucking let us out. The audience were like, this is weird, but carry on. And I sort of knew there was something in it. And every time I did a preview, I'd take more jokes out and put more story in. And it got funnier. And by the end of it, it had one joke in. And it was all the story of how I'd gone here and done this and found this bit. And so I sort of, the show I ended up with was sort of what should have been a DVD extra of the making of the show I intended to make. I just never made that show. I made this storytelling show instead. But it was a discovery. I discovered this thing I could do, which was tell stories about how things had happened and where I'd gone and have the evidence. And it was all, I didn't do PowerPoint in those days. I had an overhead projector like your geography teacher used to use and a slide projector. And I was running between the two, putting documents on one and photos on the other and like running around and being really physical on the stage. And it just, it transformed my life.
Yeah.
Because suddenly I discovered a different way of making an audience laugh.
Sure.
And it was really exciting. And the other thing it did, because when I did stand-up, when you're doing stand-up, especially in like Edinburgh, and it's a one-man show, people come on in to sit in the audience and they see a microphone in a stand on the stage in a spotlight and they go, all right, stand up. I know that. I know what I'm doing here. And a lot of them are people who wanted to see somebody else, but their show's full. And so they've ended up seeing you instead. And if they wanted to see Frank Skinner, they'll come and tell you afterwards that you weren't blue enough. And if they wanted to see David Mitchell, they'll come up and tell you afterwards you weren't clever enough. And they all think, I know what stand up is and that's not it. When they walk into a theatre and sit down, and there isn't a stand with a microphone in the middle, there's two projector screens, and there's an overhead projector here and a slide projector there. They go, fucking hell, I don't know what this is. And they accept it. And you don't have to persuade them to come to your thing anymore. They go, oh, this must be a thing. I've never seen anyone do this before. Oh, he's quite clever. And they get into it in a different way, and they don't have that preconceived notion of what it should be, which is really useful.
Yeah. But then you've created, you know, that out of that and sort of accidentally or, you know, organically, you've created a, I mean, more or less a new genre, right? I mean, there were people who did, had screens and things and might have illustrations of their show, but I think the adventure part of it.
Yeah.
Certainly for those next few shows, it was all about, can I achieve this in time? What will happen if I attempt this?
Yeah, I think the danger is that can become a contrivance.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of my favorite ever review was for, I think it was for Google Act, and the guy said, I hate Dave Gorman. I didn't want to review Dave Gorman. I've seen so many people fucking copying Dave Gorman and he's created all this shit. But I had to go and watch this. Oh my God, it's actually fucking good. And he was so surprised that he liked it, that it makes for this really amazing review.
Yeah.
And the thing that he'd seen, the reason he didn't like me, I think, and I know I'm blowing smoke up my own fundament and I apologise, was he'd seen things. His view of what I did was, having never seen it, but he thinks I'm walking on stage and saying, hi, my name's Dave Gorman and I want to meet as many people called Dave Gorman as I can. Let's go. And who gives a shit about that? And actually, the first 15 minutes of that show is me saying, so I was here and I was having this conversation and somebody said this and then I found out this. And one and together, so we ended up getting on a train, went here to meet. And 15 minutes in, everyone's thinking, well, of course, we're going to try and find another one. Because they've gone on the journey with you and discovered how and why you're doing it. And the reason you're doing it isn't, I've got an idea for a show, I'm going to do this thing. And he imagined that's all it was.
Yeah.
And then he's seen another one and effectively, I've tickled the trout. He's gone, it's not all made up and hokey. It's actually real. And he's got into it. And it's a delight. And I think I suffered from, and a reason I sort of retreated after a while of doing it, was people think you're going, I've got another wacky idea. Let's go. And it's, I think that's shit as well.
Well, I think, because it would have to escalate, it would have to get bigger and bigger, I think. And also, it's so of a time in a person's life.
Yes.
That you would be able to do. If you went out and now went, I'm going around the world to find everyone with this exact same penis as me, and I'm going to put that in a show. It's a good idea, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would. You couldn't do it as a middle-aged man.
No.
But and even as a, but again, it's this sort of it is a sort of privileged position, isn't it? That
We
found that we have, as comedians, have found ourselves in that. You know, there's nothing else, and in a way, a non-privileged position. Right, in our 30s, both of us were able to do things like that.
Yes,
because we had nothing in our lives beyond our job, and our job was to be a silly prick and see what came of that, and see what you could make out of that.
Yeah, and there is a sort of it's a self-feeding thing, because you end up in a position where I think part of the appeal for it is, or was for it, that if you're having a dinner party conversation, right, and you are the sort of person who's got a log store, so that you might be having a dinner party conversation, and somebody says, oh, I got an email at work today, and it was sent to the wrong person, because it turns out I've got the same name as a guy in Amsterdam. People might go, oh, you should go and meet him. And you can't, because you've got a car on the drive and a mortgage and a kid and a dog to walk, and you've got to do the school run, and you can't do it. And being the person who's able to go, I'll go and do that. I'll do it tomorrow. is a really liberating thing. Yeah. And then when telling people about it is rewarded, you maintain your ability to do it, because you, in doing it, you also inhibit your chances of having a dog and a school run and a thing, because you're constantly away and travelling and doing this, that and the other. And, you know, like, I sort of toured Googlewhack for like 3 years and did like 8 months in the States with it, where there was times where it was really, really exciting, but that's also 8 months where didn't really see a friend.
No.
And it was just by myself in America with a tour manager I didn't like very much. And it was just sort of weird. And I wouldn't want to go back and do it. I'm kind of glad I did it, although there were some weird... there's a section in that show where I talked about creationism. And in some parts of America, that did not go over especially well. And I was in one place, I think it was in Cleveland, I can't remember... and for some reason, a lot of the theatres had booked me for a week, and some of them insisted on having matinees as well. So I was sometimes doing like two shows on Saturday and then travelling on Sunday to a new town and doing another run. And some towns were great and some were horrible. And there's this one venue, and nobody had bought a ticket for the matinee. It was a glorious theatre. We sort of had two nice nights in it, three or four tough nights, and a matinee with nothing.
Right.
And what they ended up doing was contacting a local old people's home and bussing in a bunch of people who have never heard of me, have no desire to see a show, were just put on a bus and taken to a show to be performed by a reluctant man who thought, why didn't we all just say, let's not do this show? This is silly. And when I got to the creationism bit, there were walkouts. But one of the walkouts was a guy with an oxygen tank. And it had a wonky wheel on it. And the theatre was about four times as deep as this. And this very, very elderly man breathing into an oxygen tank with a big, heavy wheeze, taking one step at a time. And every step accompanied by a... of the wonky wheel, I had a 5 minute long noisy walkout from an octogenarian who hadn't wanted to come in the first place. That was a dark time on stage.
Yeah. And difficult to do anything about. Go, oh, look at you. Oh, no. Can't
really. Also, you know, if you believe that this is God's plan and that creationism is correct, he hasn't dealt you a fucking great hand, has he, mate? Come on.
Well, look, bloody hell. I generally thought we'd done about 25 minutes and we've been going a bit longer than that. So we'll
it's the crossword chat.
It was good. The crossword chat was... Yeah. I was trying to think up some clues, but I haven't got anything yet. I was trying to think up a Ted Rogers, like Ted Rogers, and then you could have an anagram, couldn't you? Because Ted fucks...
Yeah.
The next bit.
Yeah.
So Ted Rogers 321 and the answer is 123. But then Ted doesn't make up. You need the Ted. The Ted needs to mean something.
Yeah, but maybe if it was a down clue and you had the answers for three down, two down, and one down.
Yeah.
Then Roger's 3-2-1 could be an anagram of the first three answers.
All right, let's do that.
That would work.
Oh, it'd be so funny. It'd be so funny when they've worked it out.
Yeah. Once all the 35-year-olds have explained to them what Ted Rogers 3-2-1 is.
Right, I was going to ask you this. I'll ask you this. I don't know why this came up today as I was just sitting there, because I'm thinking about things like this all the time. One day will be the last time you are ever thought about, the last time a joke of yours is played or a book you've written is read. How many years in the future do you think that's going to be for you? Because you die, right? There's three deaths, aren't there? There's the death and there's the actual physical death. There's the death of everyone who knew you. And then there's the death of the last time you're remembered.
Yeah.
When do you think the last time you'll be remembered is? I reckon I've got 500 years. Because, should I tell you why?
Well, I think it's because you're including mentions of herring.
I think, because I've written a daily blog for basically near 19 years, and hopefully it'll be a few more years than that.
Yeah.
And I think in 500 years, and it's being archived at the British Library, and I think in 5 years' time, someone might go, oh, I wonder what people in 2020 were thinking about.
Yeah.
And the coronavirus was on, I'll look at that guy's blog. So that could still happen as an historical thing. That's my theory.
Okay.
10,000 years.
I want my obituary to be a sort of a Shelley Winters obituary.
Okay.
A Shelley Winters obituary is when the moment you find out someone was still alive is the moment you find out they are now dead.
Yeah.
That you see the obituary and go, oh, fuck, I thought they died ages ago. Still, oh no, they're not. Yeah, they're dead. And I want to be that. I want to have faded into oblivion and to have people think, God, I haven't thought about him for ages. I thought he was dead.
So you like
quite like to sort of just disappear.
You'd like people to have not thought about you while you're still alive. You're still alive and no one's thought about you.
Yeah.
And then you die and they go,
well,
oh.
Not my family, but I'd like my family to still be thinking about me while I'm alive. But I like the idea of strangers ceasing to be concerned. Genuinely, I think it'd be nice to be able to, you know, be in an old folks' home thinking, I can see it from that guy's point of view now with the oxygen tank. Yeah. And nobody else there knowing that's what's playing through your mind. That actually does appeal to me. So I'm sort of not worried about it. I have the word Gorman-esque has appeared in at least two other comedians' reviews.
Right.
And that's a weird thing. So there's the possibility of that existing, and so someone going, I wonder what that means. Yeah. And in a way, that would count. I'm kind of unconcerned about it because I will be dead.
Yeah.
So who cares?
Well, what if it's like that film?
Usually glib. My now 6-year-old is about death.
Yeah.
How are your children?
Yeah, they talk about it a lot, but they don't really get what it is.
Yeah.
And they sort of, I don't think they understand the finality of it, but maybe they do.
I think, so my mum was visiting recently, and the weekend she was visiting was the same weekend as they have the Bournemouth Air Show, which is like, there's like a million people come into town and the Red Arrows fly over and the French version of the Red Arrows fly over and it goes on for 3 days and it's a really big deal. And on the Monday morning, I was driving Eric to school and my mum wanted to come with him and have a look at his school from the car and whatever. And Eric had decided over the weekend that when he was older, he wants to be a Red Arrows pilot. So we're driving along and Eric says, I'm going to be a Red Arrows pilot when I'm older. And my mum says, well, I hope you'll give me a lift when you're Red Arrows. Can I have a lift in your plane? And he just went, you'll be dead by then. And he's right.
Yeah.
You can't deny the boy. He's right. And there's just lots of that at the moment.
There is.
Which I sort of think is okay, and it means we have lots of conversations about it and things.
Yeah.
And he wanted to... I have a... My mum's dad... There's a thing in my family called De Poitrian's contraction or something, which is Margaret Thatcher had it. Bill Nye's got it. Your fingers.
Are they in your family?
No, but
okay.
It's also known
what
as
a family.
The,
this is.
It's the thing known as the Viking claw. Okay. Lots of people with Viking blood get it, and their fingers start to do that, and you can't straighten them. And nowadays, my mum's got an operation for hers coming up in a few days' time. My older brother's had it. My uncle's had it. There's a lot of it in the family. But in the olden days, they couldn't do the operation they do now. And my granddad had two fingers missing on that hand and one on that hand, because effectively you end up with a useless hand unless you cut a finger off.
Right.
And for some reason, I don't know how that came up in a conversation, but I told Eric about my granddad having these missing fingers. And like, he sits on that information for 3 days and then says, "You know your granddad with fingers? Yeah. Will I ever meet him?" "Well, no, he's no longer alive." "Why?" Because he'd be 130. "Oh, okay. Has he still not got his fingers?" "Well, he hasn't got anything. But I'll never meet him." And he just sort of like, the death is not an emotional thing to him. And he has said, "Will you die?" And we've said, "Yes, we will." And he is not... It's like, you feel like that's a really dangerous subject to broach with a child, and they're going to have sleepless nights, and they're going to be... And he's just not remotely worried about it. Maybe he's going on the killing spree. Oh, shit. I'm going to be talked about for 600 years as the father of a murderer. Yeah.
Well, look, Dave, we have to wrap it up, because we've done such a long interview already, and it's gone flown by. And we thank you so much for coming all the way from Bournemouth.
It's my pleasure.
Some part of the way on your bike.
I did cycle some of the journey. Yeah. Yes.
So that's pretty
the cool. Final part.
Okay. The last 10 meters. It's been really lovely to see you again, ladies and gentlemen. Amazing, Dave Gorman. He is Dave Gorman. He is. We'll be back next week. See you then. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahalas Dabar with me, Richard Tarring, and my guest, Dave Gorman. Thank you to Scant Regard for playing the music. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and everyone from GoFastTheStripe.com. I'm indebted to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. Thank you to Captain McKeegan for her fantastic website, Rahalastaba.com, which helps me not ask the same questions twice too often. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFastTheStripe.com production. Go to GoFastTheStripe.com. You can buy my books and also downloads of all my stand-up shows and become a badger, monthly badger. Why not, my fan friends? Why not? Help us make more podcasts. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.